Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Books podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of the Spectator, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by Max Porter. Max is the author originally of Grief is the Thing with Feathers, which was a huge hit 2 or 3 years ago, and he's returning with a book called Lanny. Max, welcome. Lanny, what sort of book would you characterise it as? Because it's sort of like its predecessor, it's a strange mix of things.
I thought you were going to carry on.
No, I was going to say, how do you characterise it?
No, I call it a novel. Yeah, I call it a novel. It's a novel, and it's quite unapologetically borrows from techniques of play scripts and children's books and various other things, because I think that the novel should be free to do so, yeah. And I'm disappointed when novels don't use more of the things available to them. So my novels will always, I hope, have different structural elements, yeah. From different genres.
Absolutely. And it's set in a sort of village outside London, we'll let it seem. And it's got a sort of mythological element to it in the form of this character, Dead Papa Toothwort, who's a kind of presiding spirit. He's a kind of green man figure, isn't he?
Yeah.
How does it... What sort of role does he take in the book, as you see it? What's he...
He's a sort of post-green man. He's a sort of... He's a green man who understands that he's part of a storytelling tradition, but also is kitsch. So you have to load up the character with the knowledge that they are a device, a bit like the crow in my first book. What he is simply is a way for me to write language that I really enjoy writing, and I think I must get over that now. I can't do another book with another mythological character who's able to say things that human beings can't about life and death.
Well, you can.
I mean, I could, but it would get tired.
USP.
So what he is a kind of... He's a voyeur, but he's also pan-historical. He's existed since time began in this village, so he's a kind of historian, really, and is able to contextualise the behaviour he sees in the village according to sort of deep time, mythological time. So he's a kind of... For me, it was hugely enjoyable to write because he's a sort of a literary flaneur of English sensibility and history. So his job is to observe the English people in their natural habitat and sort of... It's not poking fun at them, he's enjoying them. He's a sort of pervert for English tendencies and speech patterns and things like that.
You call him a 74th generation cultural hummus sifter.
Yeah.
But he's not... I mean, there's also a sort of sense in him, I don't know whether you'd think this was fair, that he... of not quite threat, but he's, you know, he kind of enjoys... You know, the characters he doesn't like, he tears a bit of his nightmare skin off and chucks it through their windows to give him a bad dream. He sort of hugely enjoys a scene where Lanny's mother, you know, stabs to death a hedgehog.
Hmm.
There's a sense in him
of... He's danger, his darkness. He's sort of Freddy Krueger of the English village, in that he's a manifestation of people's anxieties. But in that respect, he's sort of... He's an homage to the fact that we need those characters, that society needs bogeymen. But I like the idea that your bogeyman might actually, we don't want any spoilers, but what your bogeyman might be a projection of anyway. I'm very interested in analysis, if you were to get your bogeyman on the couch and ask him how he feels, a comfier couch than the spectator couch, and ask him how he feels about having been the sort of repository of a community's anxieties, but also having been a symbolic function. And, you know, he says he's been on the cricket club logo, he's been on the beer taps, you know.
Yeah, he's kind of pissed off with the way he's represented.
Yeah, well, it's just funny to him. He's like, oh, great, now I'm a key fob, now I'm Fat Dave's back tattoo. And I want him to have a kind of knowingness about that, because he sees it in the kind of tradition of the kind of iconography of British countryside. And also, as I say, kitsch is very alluring to me anyway. I'm a collector of plastic tat, so I love the kind of green man as water in can.
But is he in some way kind of, I don't know, emasculated in the word, egreened by the sort of, you know, his recycling is kitsch, by the fact that the sort of myth and the things that traditionally give the green man power, you know, the sort of superstition, has been sort of evacuated from this village, which has become a kind of commuter dormitory.
Yeah, but I'm trying to restore it to him. If there is a sort of Anthropocene political agenda to the book, it's that actually what this special child in the book recognises, and why Toothwort is so attracted to him is that he recognises the importance of a relationship between human beings and their natural environment, and that the world will recover from the various sins done to it by human beings. So there's a sort of eco-ecstatic element to him, which I actually take quite seriously. So I want him to be funny, and I want him to be frightening, and I want him to be a bit uncanny and all the kind of things that I'm interested in as literary elements. But I want him to be pretty important as a voice in our community now.
Yeah,
which is that you've blown this, and the kind of the fundamental lie of human superiority in nature needs addressing, and actually children address it quicker and more easily than adults do.
Actually, just as you said that, I thought, is there any of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing?
I don't know.
The Swamp Thing. Oh.
It's so funny. Everyone's got one. I was in Germany last week and they went, oh, he's Katwieseler, some TV character who kind of hides in the bushes. He's Fungus the Bogeyman, I suppose, to some extent. There's a character whose name I can't remember in one of Alan Garner's early... You know, he's all those things.
Well, if you're doing myth right, presumably that's exactly what happened.
Exactly, yeah. What's your one called, Alan Moore?
Swamp Thing is a kind of DC Comics character who represents, you know, the green.
Okay, I'll look him up.
I'll dig him out for you. Yeah.
Do you have a Swamp Thing back tattoo?
I do, Roger Stone and Nixon.
I could not believe that.
That's
when you realise you're just living in a wonderful time and you've got to sit back and enjoy it. There was that, and then closely followed by the Pecker Trump dick pic Bezos thing. You know,
yes.
Pecker exposes Bezos. I mean, it was just magnificent. What a time to be alive.
Even as the world ends.
Yeah.
Now, we've talked about Dead Papa Toothwork, but you say, you know, he's got this connection with the titular character, Lanny, who's this kind of almost fairy-like boy. What's Lanny's role? Why is Papa Toothwork so attracted to him? Why is Lanny his favourite?
Well, that's the question I want the reader to be answering for themselves differently as the book progresses. Toothwort sets it up as being very interested in this child's... He's at that... what you would call that ripe age, imaginatively, where he still has childhood eccentricity and the sort of precociousness of a childhood imagination, but he's also tuning into the adult world, and that's precisely the transition that Toothwort is finding attractive and refreshing compared to the kind of what he calls grinding, lyric, practical nonsense of the adult world, you know, shopping and shagging and paying bills and everything. So in comparison to that, Lanny represents this sort of loose, ecstatic fun with language. So he finds that attractive. Then of course, you are being asked whether it's a sexualized thing, whether it's innocence versus experience and stuff like that. So I want it to be quite ambiguous what Lanny represents to all the different people in it. And I also want the adult characters in the book to possibly be... Have they imagined Toothwort? Is Toothwort a metaphor for the improper relationship? You know, I don't want any of these interpretive doors to be closed ever. I want them all open. But basically, he's childhood.
Yeah.
And you never really meet him. You never really see him or hear him. There's little bits of dialogue with him, but they're reported. He's a sort of central absence in the book.
But he's also, I think you describe him somewhere as being like a little, what do you call him? I've scribbled it down here, something. A transmitter device. You know, he's sort of singing or burbling, or he's saying things that often people are like, what's that little song he's singing that doesn't make any sense or something? I mean, does he share some of Papa Toothwort's ability to kind of absorb and transmit, to kind of pull in things from around him?
Yeah, exactly that, as children do. There's no getting around the fact that he's a strange child. There are strange children. I've met some, possibly am rearing some strange children. And that kind of, when a child realises they have a certain sort of performative power, in their eccentricity in saying weird things. But Lanny's not doing it because he's interested in it. He's genuinely quite unusual. And as you say, he sort of sucks in things he's overheard and recycles them as song or melody or strange quotations. And in that respect, he's a kind of embodiment of literary, of a sort of magpie approach to literature. He doesn't know where he's read something or heard something. It could be in a comic, it could be in a TV show, but out it comes as a sort of weirdly fully formed response to the natural world or to the adult world. And that's a very strange thing to overhear as an adult. You think, Christ, where do they get this stuff? And you realise that you're probably pumping in a fair amount of it and the rest of it is sort of being found around you and you don't realise what they're listening to. I love that when you suddenly realise a kid has been listening to an adult conversation.
Yeah, sometimes mortifying.
But also you don't perhaps realise, I read someone say they don't realise their kids are listening to the news every day when they pick them up at school, until the kid pipes up in the back going, what's sexual assault?
Yeah, yeah.
Christ,
yeah,
they listen every day to Radio 4.
I've had exactly the same thing happen with my kids.
Yeah. So yes, that's what they have in common, the two principal characters. Yeah.
And that kind of macaronic thing of pulling in different texts and fragments of text. I mean, one of the things that runs through the book, or at least certainly through the first half of the book, is in the Dead Proper Truthwort sections, you've got this sort of almost radio noise of snatches of conversation from the village. How did you sort of put that together? What was the, you know, did you sit thinking up here and just hear hundreds and hundreds of fragments of things I could imagine people saying? I mean, some of them are very funny.
Well, the ratio should be about approximately true to life. So some of it's quite funny, some of it's crushingly banal. And some of it's a bit nasty. So it's a portrait of... I hope it's true. I mean, I haven't loaded it up with any of my... I haven't judged anybody in it, and it doesn't have a sort of political agenda, that speech. That is, I hope, about what people say to one another. And there's no poetry in it. Nothing. It's not prettified, and it doesn't function as a chorus like it would in a drama or in a poem. So it is just stuff people say. And that's what he's interested in, is just the stuff of life. The point of it is exactly right what you say about radio. It's supposed to be sound, and therefore there was some discussion about whether it should even be in there. I was going to have it as a footnote, and then I was going to have it as a sort of frame, so that the text of the book itself would be printed on a sort of bed of everyday chat, and it would be up to the reader whether they tuned into it or not. And my editors felt that it was interesting enough that you actually want it embedded. And then I started to put little bits of plot, you know, so people are judging the characters, principal characters, so there's some suspicion involved, stuff like that. And then I didn't want it to be bound by the same conventions of, you know, the minute you set text, it becomes literature and therefore carries a kind of implicit mannerisms of the novel. And I wanted it to float free for that because it's sound. So we devised this kind of dancing around on the page, which seems to annoy some readers, really. Some people are able to ignore it because it dances around.
Well, a bit of me wondered whether, you know, as a publisher yourself, or former publisher yourself, you were like, I know how to annoy my publishers by making it really hard to set. And it was sort of...
We sat and did it extraordinary.
Because you've got different font sizes. And in one case, you've got it going, which I bet must be very difficult to print, right up to the edge of the page.
Yeah, I think that is quite hard, yeah. There's a woman called Kate Ward did it at Faber, and we sat with a pencil, and I steered every line, and then she went and did it. It was incredible. Collaborative, lovely process.
You did it on actual paper. You didn't, because it looks like it's been sort of computer.
Yeah, she did it on the computer, but I drew the pencil lines to show where I wanted it to go. The point is, that as his plan, he has a plan, which we will give what happens in the book away. But as his plan,
if you say the book has a
stuff
plot,
happens.
It may sound unexpected
in a book of mine. Yeah, something happens. But as that solidifies his dark intentions, that this village voice darkens on the page and squeezes together, and I really enjoyed doing that. That's lovely. And so it's almost like there's a glitch in it. And I think that's quite fun, and that borrows some of the energy of concrete poetry and stuff. And I don't know, you know, I don't know why we can't have more of that kind of fun in books. The Standard Review last night said, hilarious book about English life, really good fun. if you love books about modern life, you'll love this. Just ignore all the pretentious experimental crap with the dancing on the text. The thing is that if you engage with it, it rewards you. So I think it's worth doing. And actually, I do think that there are more ways to convey messages than we perhaps use or utilise fully in the writing of a novel. And one of them is the actual physical experience of the text on the page. And I think if you've got someone locked into a thing for a certain amount of hours, you may as well provoke them or entertain them or trick them or unnerve them in more than one way, and that text is one way of getting them to think quite carefully about what they're reading, what they believe in, and how they're relating to the text. And especially because it comes at a crucial point where you're being asked, have you been complicit in this gossip, in this sort of prurient thing?
How
also beautiful.
It's also, I think one of the few things that probably does put off is the publishing things. I remember Nicola Barker saying, because Happy has some very kind of complicated typographical
mess. It's got colour and everything.
And she said, you know, she'd pretty much expended all of her tolerance capital with her editor to get the kind of colour printing. And I'm sure that...
I think if British publishing ever runs out of tolerance capital for Nicola Barker, then we're done for.
I think so.
Let her do whatever she wants.
Exactly. One thing that made me think... Was Under Milk Wood any sort of
part of the DNA of this, because that sort of slightly dreamlike, multi-voiced quality to it, Portrait of a Community. Does everyone ask you this?
No, but it's awkward for me because, I think I read it at school. I have read Underwood at some point in my life, but I certainly haven't read it recently. I saw a little bit of a film of it recently and thought, God, I suppose I should read Underwood. And then I won the Dylan Thomas Prize. You see, some sort of ambassador in some ways. Yeah, and I've even said, gone around schools and said to people, you must read Dylan Thomas. And I did, at a time in my life, read a lot of Dylan, because my Welsh grandmother sort of was a rite of passage in her. Yeah, first you did R.S. Thomas, and if that didn't break you, then you were rewarded with the slightly more fun Dylan Thomas. But no, yeah, I haven't gone back to Under Milk
Wood. They're not very like each other, the Thomas brothers, are they?
No. Thomas Bruce. No, but you can see why my granny would have thought that if I kind of make it through the existential dread of, if I come out of the empty church alive, then I get a bit of boozy bonking and kind of teenage, what's it all about stuff as my reward. Yeah. It worked, actually. It worked beautifully.
That thing you were talking about, the way you wanted it as voice, and, you said, when I said, what sort of book is it? You said, oh, it's a novel. But people, you draw on techniques of the play. You've got, it's very oral. I mean, is this something, I know you're hot foot from the South Bank, where you've just been presenting an abridged version of it with actors doing different parts. I mean, do you want it to be read aloud? Is it a book that people should be reading aloud to themselves?
I think I want everything to be read aloud, really, because I'm very interested in the oral tradition, and I think we have lost... I'm kind of the Alice Oswald, Alan Garner school, that the oral tradition is where the energy comes from, and that we have gradually flattened all that energy out. You would probably have comparable opinions about rhetoric and public speaking and the kind of flatness of social media, the sort of extremity of opinion but ultimately flatness of you can achieve on social media and stuff. And the way we now communicate has lost the artfulness and delicacy and nuance and possibility, performative possibilities of good public speaking. Do people read novels aloud to themselves? I don't know. I write my novels musically. I listen to music while I write, or I certainly listen to music while I think, so that I hope there is rhythm in there.
What was the soundtrack to this? Were you listening to kind of pounding industrial techno?
Yeah, exactly. No, lots of English folk music and sort of... I listen to electronic music with no lyrics, so I need to be nodding my head, and then I would stop and listen to something very, very beautiful. I want to flood the thing with feeling. I hope that a novel can have almost prose poem levels of linguistic adventure on every page. I don't think a novel, the way that novels sort of settled into its skin as a sort of, that we expect to have great 15-page long boring bits in between the exciting. I don't know why you have to do that. I think every page can be kind of burnished. One of my reviewers called it whittled, which was the greatest compliment to me, that the prose might be whittled, because that to me is as close a description as I can get to what it is. You start out with something unsatisfactory or familiar, and you whittle it until it's revelatory or beautiful even. And that seems like a decent working definition of why you'd write.
Grief had a great welcome, which to you, I think, or to those people, because it was an unusual, original book, was a surprise for a lot of people. I mean, it's very, it wasn't sort of an obvious book to suddenly become a huge bestseller. I think. I mean, maybe that's a fair characterisation. Was it?
I don't think it became a huge bestseller. Always remember, a literary bestseller is still only doing a fraction of what Alex Ferguson's latest biog's doing,
Yeah.
We're talking literary. But
It had a substantial welcome. Was that kind of freeing in the sense you thought, right, I can be confident in doing what I do? Or was it slightly like, shit, how do I do that again?
No, freeing. Readers will go anywhere you want with them, and even people will queue up and say, I've never read a book like this, and I loved it. It was different. That's a great encouragement that readers will go with you. But also, I sort of thought I wrote it accidentally, So actually, the kind of pro choice, sitting down, thinking, right, I'm going to try and do this, or for example, I'm going to try and create a character in absentia, or I'm going to try and create a chorus like effect, or there were sort of proper formal undertakings that I'd not quite scratched. So it's a continuation of the project. My next book probably won't be like this. It won't be built of small bits.
Continuation project. Do you think of them as linked books?
I think of them as related in as much as they're trying to solve a similar problem, and they share core thematic things which needed to be worked through. I needed to find a form for both projects. So the form, the triptych, and the use of the crow as a kind of way to get at literary homage in the first book, and similarly the mythological figure as a way to get to community and parental anxiety and stuff in this book. They seem to me linked, yeah. But maybe, I mean, books are linked, aren't they? Writers are at work on certain projects. I think it's more obvious with some writers than others. If you think, I mean, I've been rereading Elizabeth Taylor. She's at work on the similar set of concerns, and you can see that she's coming at it from a different angle. Someone like Paul Auster is obviously, he's a project novelist, isn't he? You know, he's trying to solve the same problem over many, many books. For me, the kind of anxiety, if there is an anxiety, comes at that, is at the structural stage. Is how do I know what I want to do, and I know I'm fine on the line. How do I, what shape is it going to take? So it's, for me, it's sort of architectural issue.
You've given the Lanny's parents, his mother is a writer, though she's a crime writer.
What do you mean, though she's a crime writer?
Sorry.
If that's less
though
than a
she's
writer.
A crime writer. Why did I say that?
He's a cricket. Well, he's a wicket keeper, really. Yeah, she's a crime writer. Well, she's trying to write a crime novel.
She's a crime writer. Yeah. Well, what I meant was she wasn't a figure for the writer of the book in that sense.
Oh, no.
But why did you make her a writer? Was that just a nice postmodern twist, or was it because there's
no,
a crime
no, I wish
story
it was,
here,
actually. I made her a writer because she needed to be... She's a creative person, and I know from myself that she's stopped acting. Her career didn't take off as an actor. She had a child. They've moved to the country. People of a certain... It'll need output. I mean, do you know people like this? You know, I'm like this. I have to do something. If I'm not drawing, you know, I have to draw or paint or have a craft project going on or even be tiling the bathroom or something. I have to, and she's like that. So she started writing. And she's also started writing as to formulate some of the anger she has, and the postnatal depression led her to some quite interesting, I think, interesting thinking that happens more in the visual arts than in literature about women's bodies and relationship to the bodies of children and the sort of eroticism of parenting and the sort of ways in which women's bodies are a sort of battleground for the kind of consumer industry of parenting and that kind of thing. So she's interested in the world, and she's frustrated, and she's got loads of time because the kids are at school the whole time, so she started to write. And she's obviously connected enough in London to have got herself an agent and sold a book proposal.
And Lanny's father... He's your basic London commuter, isn't he? He's got a sort of city job. Did you want him to be a figure for everything that wasn't Green Man World?
Slightly, yeah. But people are very unkind about him. People think he's a git, which is a shame because I think he's sweet and forgivable and like us, you know, like people I know. He's struggling with the. He's a part-time countryman, you know, and he doesn't know where he belongs, and he doesn't feel fully realised at home. He doesn't feel that he belongs at work, and so he spends all his time on the train, and that's a frustrating way to live. And he suffers from the kind of spiritual emptiness that a lot of people do now. They spend their whole time gazing at their phone, and work's not especially satisfying, and all he really wants to do is be loved and get laid and have friends and be liked. He's sort of got a sort of... He fetishizes respectability, you know, he wants to be liked in the pub and he wants to be liked at home, and he just is baffled by this strange, eccentric son of his. So he's sort of, he's a kind of zeitgeist creation in that respect, yeah, and the kind of emptiness, existential emptiness that we all suffer from now. Slaves to our iPhones, strangers to our loved ones.
Make me cry.
But did you like
him? I sympathised with him, yeah. I found him... I mean, particularly when all he was looking forward to was chicken wrapped in bacon. And he doesn't get it.
Never gets his chicken wrapped in bacon, no.
You have a lovely line about the chicken sitting there being a chicken that's destined never to be cooked.
Yeah.
Do you live in town or in the country, Max?
I live in Bath.
You live in Bath?
So, brilliantly, my German publisher did a press release saying I lived in a tiny village, and I had to say on behalf of the people of Bath, we're actually a moderate-sized city. I live on the edge of Bath, in a village, in a sort of village-like bit of Bath. But this predates that move. We classic move out of London for a bit more space and nicer people and better countryside. And I wanted to be near my brother in Bristol and so on. So it is not a Bath novel. my next novel will be a Bath novel. It's going to be called The Tutting Capital of the World, which is what Bath is. If you go into Waitrose with some children at 4 p.m. on a Saturday, you will literally be assaulted by tuts. People just stand and go, oh, oh, and your children say things like, can we have Marmite? And go, oh, oh. It's incredible. I think it's a particular meeting of, it's a sort of conference of factors, cultural and socioeconomic, that means that there is as much tutting in Bath as there is. I'm very affectionate about it, but it's a problem for them.
Well, there's about to be a mythological tutting figure you can work on. So.
Yeah, Uncle Tut.
Well, that's a world exclusive. Grief is a Thing with Feathers, Lanny, and the third in the trilogy, The Tutting Capital of the World. Max Porter, thanks very much.
Thanks, Sam.
You were listening to The Spectator's Books podcast. I very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.